Welcome to Sparks of History, where world history and Jewish history meet. Today, we are very honored to have with us Rabbi Mordechai Becher. Rabbi Becher is a noted international lecturer and author. Rabbi Becher received rabbinic ordination from the chief rabbinate in Israel, as well as from the chief rabbi of Jerusalem. Rabbi Becher also earned an MA in medieval Jewish history from the Bernard Revel Graduate School. In numerous institutions, both in Israel and abroad, including Neve Yerushalayim, Darche Bina, or Sameach, and has also served as a senior lecturer at Gateways. Rabbi Becher has also authored a number of books, Gateway to Judaism, The What, How, and Why of Jewish Life, After the Return, A Practical Halachic Guide for the Newly Observant, Soul Food, A Summary of the Laws of Kosher Food, and explanations of the reasons behind it. Currently, Rabbi Becher is a senior lecturer in Jewish history and philosophy at Yeshiva University. And today we'll be covering and discussing a fascinating topic, the Aleppo Codex. And I'm sure it's going to be very, very informative for our viewers and listeners. Again, Rabbi Becher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to begin, a little bit about your background and how you became interested in the Aleppo Codex.
It's actually a good question. I'm not exactly sure. But I would say two things. Number one, I had the opportunity when I was visiting England to go to Cambridge University and to see the Cairo Geniza, where very generously we were given an entire day. And the curator and various researchers there at the Geniza research unit, and it was a fascinating experience to see autograph copies of the Mishneh Torah of Maimonides, to see a letter of Yehuda Halevi in his own handwriting, to see these type of things just really seized the imagination and really inspired me. So that was, I think, one thing that made me interested, created some more interest in these manuscripts. In addition, I was doing my master's in medieval Jewish history, and the Aleppo Codex was referred to in one of my classes, which was the On the Jews of Islam by Professor Daniel Tzadik. I took, I think, four courses with him about the Jews of Islam, and during our study of the Jews of Syria, we had some extensive discussion about the Aleppo Codex. And so I guess those are some of the features or some incidents that I guess have made me interested in this subject.
What exactly is the Aleppo Codex and what does it contain?
Okay. So, as you know, the technology of the Torah scroll has not changed for 3,000 or so years. It's a scroll. The Romans came up with an idea of, instead of using a scroll, which, of course, as anyone who's been in shul knows, when it's rolled to the wrong place, is somewhat of a nightmare. You have to roll it back and forth, you know, etc. Chiropractors are happy with it, but no one else. So the Romans came up with the idea of a notebook, in other words, folding parchment in half, binding it together into leaves or pages, and sometimes using papyrus, sometimes using parchment. And they created the book or a codex, which became in common use by around the 4th century. The Jews, so that's what a codex is. A codex basically is a book which contains a specific type of text. Now, the Aleppo Codex, it got the name Aleppo Codex much later in its history. Really, it was written by a group, primarily the Ben Aaron family in Tiberias in the 9th century. And later on, through its incredibly fascinating history, was transported to Aleppo in Syria, in Hebrew called Halav, or in Arabic Halav, or in Hebrew Aram Soba, and in the Syrian pronunciation. And it was there for a long time, which I guess we'll probably discuss at some point. And so it became known as the Keter Aram Soba, or the crown of Aram Soba, Ktaj in Arabic. And basically it's a Tanakh, meaning it's the Torah, five books of the Torah, the entire 24 books of the Torah, prophets and writings. But it's more than that, because it was an attempt to preserve the oral traditions of the written text. What is an oral tradition of a written text? Well, you have the written text of the Torah, as anyone has seen a Torah scroll. There's no punctuation. There are no vowels. I mean, there are some of the Hebrew letters, but there's no vowel sounds. So is the word pronounced chalav or chalev? Chalav meaning milk, chalev meaning fat. Is it year air he will see, year air he will be seen, year ah he will fear, year ah he will show? Right. So you need to have an oral tradition, meaning you need to hear someone pronounce it in order to know how to read it. And in terms of punctuation, not even sentence divisions. So the punctuation is supplied by what we call Tame HaMikra, the way we sing it. And the singing divides up phrases, puts emphasis on certain words, combines words, divides words, creates the sentences, and so on and so forth. But all that, until the time of the Aleppo Codex, that period was preserved in an oral fashion. You'd have to hear it from someone who heard it from someone, you'd teach it to someone. So this group of Jews known as the Masoretes, Masorah means tradition, as in Fiddler on the Roof, tradition, Masorah. So there is an attempt to preserve all of that in written form with vowelization of the Hebrew words that we call today nekudot. Not only nekudot means dots, but it's really dots and dashes, etc. And of course, with the Tame HaMikra, Ashkenazim call trop, which are also the cantillation notes, that they put all of that into a text of the Tanakh. And they added to it also notes about spelling of words, which is different spelling in different manuscripts. They noted that. They noted sometimes how often a word appears. They noted a word that appears only once in the entire text. They made many, many notes, a lengthy version, Masorah Magna, the great Masorah, a smaller version, the Masorah Parva. That does not mean anything to do with meat and milk. That's Latin for short or small. So, and that is really what was put in. That's the Aleppo Codex. That's what it is.
Pretty much. As you mentioned, the Ben Asher, this was a family. This was
Ben Asher, yes. Not Ben Asher, sorry, Ben Asher. Yeah.
These were a group of scholars during which period? This parallels the Gaonic period.
It's towards the end of the Gaonic period. The Gaonic period usually is considered to end around the beginning of the 10th century, mid-11th century. Let's say 1035 is the death of the last of the Gaonim. So we're talking about in the 10th century, 9th and 10th century. It was towards the end of the Gaonic era. So what happened is that Tiberias, which is a city on the western shore of the Kinneret, as you know, one of the four holy cities of the land of Israel, founded by Herod Antipas, so and named for the emperor Tiberius. So it became a center of Jewish study already in the second, third century. A lot of the Mishnah was compiled there. The Jerusalem Talmud was edited in Tiberias 200 years later. And Saladin eventually put an end to Crusader power there. But the Jewish community flourished in Tiberias. And it was a center, and now there it was like a perfect storm situation. First of all, Muslim conquest around the Middle East, there was a rise of Arabic and concurrently a decline in the use of Hebrew. So this group of scholars, family, Ben Asher family and others, wanted to preserve the authentic Hebrew script, etc. Also, the Muslims imported papermaking technology from China, which made it possible technically to produce some really nice works like the Codex. Also, there was a rise of Karaite influence. Now, the Karaites were a group of Jews, began around in the 10th century, who who believed only in the written law, not in the oral tradition. On the positive side, that meant that they had tremendous respect and veneration of the text of the Torah. So if you had these people who, so that was also somewhat an influence. An influence on the in the sense that there was a great interest in the biblical text. On the other hand, as opposed to the Karaites, there was now an impetus to preserve and reinforce the Masorah or the oral tradition. So the Karaites was type of like an influence on the positive and the negative side. The positive side is the veneration of the text. So we're competing with them in venerating them. Oh, yeah, we'll do it better, right? But on the other hand, there was the Karaite rejection of the oral tradition. So in our text, we're going to put in the oral tradition. So there was that. And it was also a scholarly, political, economic, and cultural capital of Israel almost of the time. So the Masoretes really tried to do a few things. First of all, as I said, the vocalization of the text, meaning nikud. The cantillation, the way you sing it, which is, of course, as I said, the punctuation, which we call ta'ame hamikra, and the textual accuracy, variations, defective or plané spelling. You know, there are words in Hebrew you could say, just random example, omer, he said, aleph vav mem resh, would read omer. That's a plané spelling, a full spelling. Or you could write it as aleph mem resh, and you could still read it omer, right? Put a dot on the top. That's called a defective spelling, right? So they wanted to record all of these things. And the Balei Masorah, they worked for probably about six generations. When exactly they started, it's unclear. But they produced the culmination of it all was the 24 books of the Torah in the form of the Aleppo Codex. One of the scribes' name was Shlomo ben Buya'a, who actually did the writing, which is beautiful script. Probably the head of the person in charge of the venture was a Rav Aaron ben Asher of the ben Asher family. And they completed this codex. And by the way, we know these because there was a colophon. Colophon is basically a dedication page. If you find the colophon, usually at the end, sometimes at the beginning, then you've got it made. It'll give you the author, it'll tell you the scribe, give you the place, et cetera, et cetera. So that was those were the Masoretes.
Going back to the Karaites, the Karaites, as you mentioned, were very interested in the Aleppo Codex. And if I remember correctly from my reading, that the Codex was initially housed in a Karaite synagogue, perhaps I think it was in Cairo, if I'm not mistaken. So why were they that interested in the Aleppo Codex if the Aleppo Codex represented the oral tradition on the written law?
Good question. So the cantillation and the vowelization represented the oral law, that is true. But the text, which was so carefully written, so beautifully written and so carefully preserved with every variation and so on and so forth, that was of great interest to the Karaites. They are interested in the text of the Torah. They consider it to be holy. The only thing that is holy is the text of the Torah. In addition to which, now they do make deductions from the text. They used a method called qiyas, which is Arabic, roughly translates into Hebrew as hekesh, meaning logical comparisons, etc., which means if you are using, they did use deductive logic, they did use their minds and spara, so that means it was important for them to have an accurate text, especially since that's all they had was the text. So this was important to them. And actually, yes, a Karaite, wealthy Karaite family did buy the Aleppo Codex and brought it to Jerusalem initially, which is a part of its history. It moved from Tiberias to Jerusalem, and actually it was in the possession of the Karaites. But type of interestingly, these Karaites did allow rabbinite scholars, meaning us, people who are believed in the oral Torah, to look at it and to investigate it. Because so it was really interesting because the Aleppo Codex is therefore a unique book in the sense that it is of great value to two completely opposing camps, but for similar reasons. So the Rabbinites were interested in this because of the preservation of the oral traditions of the written law, but also because we hold the text to be holy, as you know, right? Anyone who's a Bal Korah and makes a mistake gets shouted at by 50 people in public in the shul because what he said, instead of, that's right. One letter's missing. That's it. So it's of great interest to us, but we are also interested in it in the sense of the oral part of it, etc. And the Karaites also interested because of the sanctity of the text and the accuracy of the preservation job that were done here.
What happened to the Codex, to the Aleppo Codex, during the First Crusade?
So it is believed that it was basically what happens is the Codex is intact and in Jerusalem by the 10th century. In the 11th century, 1071, Jerusalem was attacked by the Turkish Seljuks, who seized control from the Shiite Fatimids. So again, Sunni Turks and the capturing Jerusalem from the Shiite Fatimids, Sunni and Shiites being the two of the major Muslim sects, the Shiites being in the minority. Then the Fatimids retake Jerusalem. Then eventually, 1099, the Crusaders capture Jerusalem. 1096 is the beginning of the First Crusade. We know a very tragic time for the Jewish people, especially in the Rhineland. But the Crusaders were always short of cash. Is this huge army to support, and they're extended, and the supply chain, we have heard of issues like that. Supply chain was an issue back then as well, probably worse. So the Crusaders, like most thugs, resorted to many ways to make money. Kidnapping people, some Crusader castles, as you know, in Israel, amazingly, have graves in them of famous biblical characters, right? Because now they could charge entrance. So they build a castle. They say, oh, wow, we found the grave of Noah. I think it's in Tzfat. Obviously not the grave of Noah. No one has a clue where he's buried, but you can charge entry fees now, right? And so they make money. So they, it is believed that the crown, the Keter, this codex was taken either by the Seljuks, more likely by the Crusaders, and held for ransom. It was held for ransom. So it was in Jerusalem, in the possession of some Karaites. It was redeemed for ransom. There is a letter we have in the Cairo Geniza, which talks of people who were redeemed from the Franks referring to the Crusaders from France. Some are in danger of dying from want of food and clothing and exhaustion, others remain in captivity. All this, in addition to the money, now this is from Cairo community writing this, who say that in the money that, so we sent money to help the Jews who were starving to redeem Jews from captivity. And at the end, there's a few lines that says this, all this in addition to the money that was borrowed and spent in order to buy back 230 Bible codices, 100 other volumes, 8 Torah scrolls. So you see, the Cairo community, which was fairly affluent, spent money ransoming stuff, material from the Crusade. So it appears that the Cairo community was able to ransom the... this is, by the way, from Gotian in Hayishuv Be'eretz Yisrael, from one of his books about the Cairo Geniza. And so there, it was ransomed by the Jews of Fostat. Fostat was a suburb of Cairo where the Rambam lived, most famously. And in the early 12th century, it was redeemed by them.
So now it's in Cairo, and yes. It's available for the Rambam, Maimonides, to inspect. Did the Rambam validate the accuracy of the Aleppo Codex, and what are the implications of that ruling?
Well, type of interesting, the Rambam in his Mishnah Torah, Hilchos Sefer Torah, in the 8.4, the Rambam discusses this, and he says, First of all, he says, I've seen a lot of mistakes. Ra'iti shibush gadol b'chol ha'sfarim shara'iti bidvarim. I saw a lot of mistakes in the books. Now, here he's referring to mistakes more, not so much in the spelling or in the words, not at all. He talks about the what's called petuchot and stumot, meaning the open chapters where a chapter of the Torah ends with a space at the end of the line, petucha, open, stumot, where the chapter ends at a space in the middle of a line. And he says, we've got a lot of mistakes in the way we do that. In addition, the amount of lines used in writing things, specifically things like the Shira, the song, which is written a very specific way in the Torah, like the Song of the Red Sea, Shiras Hayam, Shiras Ha'azinu, Shiras Ha'be'er. And he says, this, I'll just read what he says. I'm going to tell you how to write the Parshiot Stumot and Petuchot. I want to tell you how to write the open and closed paragraphs. I'm going to also tell you how to write exactly the format of the songs. And he says, I'm basing it, Sefer Shesamachnu Alav, the book upon which we have relied, Bidvarim Elu, in all these things, Hu HaSefer HaYadua B'Mitzrayim, is the well-known book in Egypt, Shu Kolel Arba Esrim V'Sfarim, right, which includes the 24 books of the Torah, prophets, and writings, Shehaya Birushalayim Kamash, that was in Jerusalem a number of years and has now come here to Cairo. And he says, Samachti, I relied on this, and the Sefer Torah that I had written in Cairo, we don't have that Sefer Torah, but the Sefer Torah that I commanded to be written is based on this text. Now, it is widely believed, based on a fair amount of evidence, that this is a reference to the Aleppo Codex, which had gone from Tiberias to Yerushalayim in the hands of Karaites, captured by the Crusaders, ransomed by the Jews of Fostat, seen by the Rambam, and indeed, who says, it's wonderful, we should rely on this, it is excellent.
And we've moved to Egypt, to the suburb of Cairo, and now the Codex gets to Aleppo.
Ah, yes.
How does it get from Egypt to now Aleppo, Syria?
So Maimonides, who, aside from being a great Torah scholar, physician, leader of the Jewish, Ra'is al-Yahud, the head of the Jews of Cairo, known as the Nagid in Hebrew, his son, grandson, great-grandson were all Nagidim. They were all leaders of the Cairo community. His great-great-great-grandson, David, moved to Aleppo in 1375. We think that he took the Codex with him to Aleppo in Syria. So it's the Rambam's descendants who moved to Syria, to specifically Aleppo, Halab, and he brings the Codex with him. And there it is believed that that's when it got there, sometime in the 14th century, around 1375, it is believed that so once it got to Aleppo, that's when it became known as the Aleppo Codex. The Aleppo community put it in the great synagogue of Aleppo, Halab Aram Soba. It was in a locked safe. It was guarded very, very tenaciously, very, very, there were curses written for anyone who would touch it, look, et cetera, et cetera. They were very, very careful about this, and access to it very restricted. But it became the crown of the community, as they were proud of this. They were the preservers of this, the protectors of this, and it was a matter of communal pride that they had this codex, and hence it became known as from that time on, the Taj Aram Sova, the Aleppo Codex.
When did the biblical scholar Umberto Casuto inspect the codex, and what is his claim regarding it?
So there is an Italian scholar by the name of Umberto Casuto. I love his name. Just like, how often do you get a scholar called Umberto? I mean, so Umberto Casuto was in Israel. He actually was allowed to examine the codex in the early part of the, I think it was the 1930s, perhaps, I don't remember, or 20s. He was not allowed to take photos of it. He has a letter he writes in which he says, I could not take photos. The people in Aleppo said, if I take photos of it, all the curses will fall upon me and them. But he was able to look at it and examine it draw some conclusions about it. We don't have the full text of his conclusions, but Umbercus, who he eventually moved to Jerusalem, became a professor at Hebrew University. You might know that there's a street in Beit Vegan, Rehov Kasuto. He wrote a very famous book, the Eight Lectures on the Documentary Hypothesis and a Commentary on the Torah. Wonderful scholar. He was of the opinion that the Aleppo Codex that the Rambam, or that rather the Codex that the Rambam saw and writes about in the Mishnah Torah, was not the Aleppo Codex. The basis for him saying that was, we don't know all of his reasoning, but one reason we do know is that the Rambam says that Shirat Hazinu, the Song of Hazinu, should be written as 70 lines. And he says, if you look in the Aleppo Codex, it's written in 67 lines. He says, so it can't be. Now, the there are those who disagree. I mean, first of all, the descriptions of the Aleppo Codex from various people throughout history match the descriptions of people in Cairo. The journey of the Aleppo Codex matches exactly that it should be in Cairo at the time of the Rambam. Much of the evidence points towards it being that what the Rambam saw was the Aleppo Codex. What do you do with the 70 and 67? There are scholars who point out that in one of the oldest manuscripts of the Mishnah Torah of the Rambam, and there are many, many manuscripts, but if you look in one of the oldest manuscripts, it was, I forgot from where, but there, that manuscript, it's the it's in Bodleian Library in Oxford. It's the Huntington 80 manuscript of the Rambam. I never saw that in Yeshiva, but it's in the Oxford. It says 67 lines. So maybe, I don't know that, yeah, but Kasuto was uncertain if this was the one. Most other scholars disagree. And it does seem that this was that what the Rambam saw was indeed the Aleppo Codex.
And now we're moving a little further in history. The state of Israel is about to emerge, and events are warming up in Syria and Aleppo. What happened to the Codex during the anti-Jewish riots in Aleppo of 1947?
Right. So as we know, the Syrian government encouraged riots against the Jews, not that the population needed a lot of encouragement. And the riots were took the form of burning down the great synagogue. There were many Jews beaten. There were many Jews. There were many of the rapes, and some people died during this. And it was horrific. So, knowing that the Codex, this most treasured piece of Jewish history, was in the, a lot of the Syrian Jews took great pains to try and save it from the fire. So it was saved. We think it was Murad and Sarina Faham. We're not exactly sure that many Syrian Jews claimed to have been the ones to save it, whether it was the Gabai, whether it was probably a group effort. And it was taken out of the shul. It looks like, it appears that what we have of it is, I think, about 60% in the form that we have now. But people took pages of it. People took hid pages. It doesn't seem to have been burnt. It used to be believed that a lot of it got burnt. However, on investigation, one of these scholars in Israel, when it eventually got there, found that what was thought to be burn marks was actually a fungus that had infested so basically what happened at this point was that Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who was the second president of the State of Israel, was also a historian. Now, there was a unit, in the Israeli intelligence called Unit 504, Intelligence Unit 504. And they were responsible for intelligence activities amongst Jewish communities in the diaspora, which is a bit of a weird thing, you know, weird job, but that was their role. Now, they were the people, by the way, who were able to obtain a lot of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Sami Nachmias and Shmuel Goren, who was the commander of this of the military intelligence 504. So Yitzhak Ben Svi knew about the Aleppo Codex, and he knew that the Syrian Jews had hid it after these riots, and he tasked the Mossad. Mossad's interesting. It's like here you have an intelligence unit, but they do things that are a little weird. They're looking for a kidnapped kid in the case of Yosela. They'll hunt down Nazis. They'll take revenge against the Munich terrorists, etc. It's not just intelligence gathering. And one of the things that they were tasked with doing was getting the Aleppo Codex back. So a number of Syrian Jews helped the Mossad, so someone by the name of Rafi Sutton, who Sutton is a very famous Syrian Jewish name, and a number of the Syrian Jews helped. It was eventually smuggled out of Syria, I think via Iran, which at the time was under the Shah, from Iran to Turkey, and then Turkey eventually to Israel, where unfortunately initially was not treated well. It was placed in a filing cabinet. I mean, I don't know, is this because of Israeli bureaucracy, or I have no idea, but it ends up in a filing cabinet. Eventually, it was moved to what they call the Yad Ben Svi, and they started to really do a lot of preservation. There's a Michael Magen, who is the head of the paper conservation lab at the Israel Museum, and he did a lot of preservation work on the Codex. But we also, because a lot of it was missing, we had to resort to other ways to figure out the missing stuff. So first of all, over the course, since the 1950s, when it was taken to Israel, until now, pages have cropped up. Syrian Jews have found pages here and there and given it to Israel, to the Yad Ben Svi, and to the Israel. Now it's in the Israel Museum, Shrine of the Book. And so more and more of it has got together. But we have some other important sources. First of all, there are the notes of Umberto Casuto, who did examine it. And there's a fascinating story. There was a Rav Sholem Shachna Yellen in the late 19th century who was a soifer, a scribe from Vilna, and not Vilna, but from Lithuania. And he wanted to, one of his life's goals was to make Aliyah, and also he wanted to see the Aleppo Codex. So he did get to make Aliyah, but he became ill and he could not go to Aleppo to see it. So he sent his son-in-law. And his son-in-law took his father-in-law's Tanakh and went there and took notes on the entire Tanakh of the Aleppo Codex, the Masorah, the various spellings, word changes, different, et cetera, et cetera. That actually got lost. That Tanakh was lost until sometime in the 70s. So Roshon Sachia had lived in Kiryat Moshe. I used to live there. And they were demolishing an apartment building in which he lived, and they found a boydom. It's like a sealed in Israeli apartments. You have a space sometimes between the ceiling and the roof, and you can use that to store things in. So anyway, they found the Tanakh, and that was given to Yad Yitzhak Ben Svi. And so we had sources of that sort throughout history. There were also questions that were sent to the people in Aleppo. Someone, I forgot who it was, sent a list of questions about different spellings and words, and they would be able to answer yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. So all these sources, came together and were used in actually the Hebrew University, based on the Aleppo Codex and some of these other sources, produced what they call Keter Yerushalayim, which is a wonderful Tanakh that is based primarily on the Aleppo Codex, but also uses the notes of Rav Sholem Shachna Yellen and used some of the work of Casuto and other sources to put together this uh, reconstruction of that original codex.
Does that the reconstruction, if the Aleppo Codex that was extant from the riots in 47 that came to Israel in 58, if we're talking about 60% of the codex, did the reconstruction move that number up from 60 to a higher number? And where are we today in that?
I don't know the exact percentage, but it did move it up. Yeah, I can't tell you an exact percentage, but pages have been recovered, have been donated. See, when you have, let's say, notes in someone's Tanakh, that's not going to move the percentage up. But nevertheless, it will tell you what was the codex's version of this letter, this word, et cetera, et cetera. So does that move the percentage up? Could be. But so I can't give you a percentage, but it was moved. It has been moved up. Another aid in it was using the other famous codex from Tiberius, which is known as the Leningrad Codex, which is from also from early 11th century, dated back to 1009. It's called Leningrad Codex because although it was written in Cairo, it was originally in Cairo, but it stayed in Egypt for hundreds of years and then turned up in Russia in the 19th century, bought by a Karaite, wealthy Karaite businessman. And of course, Leningrad, it was in Leningrad, but once Russia became the Soviet Union and everything was nationalized, so was this. And it is now in St. Petersburg in the National Library, but it still has, it's not called the St. Petersburg Codex, even though Leningrad is now called St. Petersburg. It's still called the Leningrad Codex. And that also has complete Bible written on the colophon. It says it was written by Shmuel ben Yaakov in 1009 CE, written and finished with Nikud, meaning vowelization, beautifully proofread in Egypt in the month of Sivan, 4,770th year of creation. So because we have the colophon, and it's actually more, it's intact. It's not unlike the Aleppo Codex. It didn't go through riots. There doesn't seem to be damage by fungus. Pages are not missing. So it actually is very helpful in that sense. And it was also used by the Hebrew University in that Keter Yerushalayim Tanakh.
We had interviewed a while back Professor Lauren Schiffman on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And two of the things that he had mentioned was, number one, was that, first of all, the Dead Sea Scrolls over the years became available to the general public. And everything is online now, and the general public really has access for the first time to the Dead Sea Scrolls. He also said that there's a lot of potential future research, ink analysis, using all kinds of new technologies. Is there anything is there something similar happening with the Aleppo Codex like the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Not to the same degree. It's much more recent. I mean, the Dead Sea Scrolls, we're talking about 200 years ago. Also much more controversial in its content in terms of what it says about early Christianity, what it says about Jewish sectarianism, what it says about authenticity of various biblical traditions and the Tehillim and so on and so forth. So I guess people have found it much more interesting than whether this word is spelled with a vav or a yud, right? Or whether the cantillation is a mercha or a tipcha. I guess less interesting to people and less less controversial, less momentous. But nevertheless, work is still being done on it. There is still scholarship being done. There is analysis being done on its ink. And as I said, there's Israel Museum, is primarily involved in that. And it is also being, it is used in a scholarly way to help publish new versions of the or versions of the Tanakh, which are accurate and which involve the cantillation and vowelization of them. And there's interest in the Masorah Magna, the Masorah Parva, the various notes they have that actually have been reprinted. in, I forgot who did it, but there is, maybe it was not Coran, but it has been reprinted in a new modern version of that.
Why should young people, general public of young people, and perhaps young people that come from a traditional background, why should they study the Aleppo Codex and its history?
Good question. I would think that, first of all, the Aleppo Codex, to some degree, almost parallels a lot of our own personal Jewish history. Here is something which originates in Israel, which is captured by crusaders. If you're talking about a human being, this could be the story of a Jew, right? Created in Tiberias, captured by crusaders in Jerusalem, ransomed by Jews in Cairo, moved from Cairo to Aleppo, Syria, spirited by the Mossad, attacked by anti-Semites, spirited by the Mossad back to the state of Israel. It's a, first of all, an intriguing story in and of itself. It's a story, I think, that parallels a lot of the Jewish people, right? We all originated in Israel, as our soul came from Israel, but where did it go? Who was it captured by? How was it redeemed? Where did it end up? So to some degree, I think study of the Aleppo Codex is really study of our own personal histories. And it does present fascinating insights into different Jewish communities. Tiberias, which today is a commercial and tourist center. You go there to go swimming in the Kinneret, but people don't realize that Tiberias, Tveria, was one of the great Torah centers of our history. So it gives you a new appreciation of some aspects of the land of Israel. The recognition of the fascination of the Karaites and the Talmid HaChomim of the Rabbinites with the Aleppo Codex. Again, if you are interested in Chumash, if you're interested in Torah Shel Peh, Mefarshim, this is something of interest in general. The fact that it is seen and discussed by the Rambam is just amazing, that his great grandson takes it to Aleppo. So I think there's a lot of I think that's a fascinating story in and of itself, and the Fostat community is a fascinating community. Then the Aleppo community, there is a large Syrian community today in Israel, in New York, in Deal, this is part of their heritage. And a lot of young people have only heard of Aleppo in the context of the of wars in Syria. I think to think of Aleppo as one of the great Jewish communities of the world, with scholars and preserving. I mean, can you think about the fact that here is this thing comes there in the 14th century, and is there for until 1947. And then in hiding until 1958, and now it's in the state of Israel. I mean, that in and of itself, that longevity of the preservation and the degree of veneration for it is also interesting, and something to think about in terms of the Aleppo community. And then its current, I find it interesting that here is a sovereign state that's just got enough, not like the state of Israel didn't have enough problems in 1958. Right, that the president is worried about getting some obscure book from a city in Aleppo, which some Syrian family has hidden, is when the Quran calls us al kitab, the people of the book. This is a classic example. That's not what the Quran meant, but here is a great example: the Jewish passion for the book and for the Torah, and as expressed in this book, really says something. And I tell students that there's a poem by Heinrich Heine, a German poet, born Jewish, unfortunately tragically baptized, but insightful. He writes that the Torah is the portable homeland of the Jewish people, and he's so correct. Jews moving around Tveria, Yerushalayim, Fostat, Cairo, Aleppo, Iran, Turkey, Israel. That whole movement, that's the one constant in Jewish geography. The one constant in Jewish history is the book, the Torah. And the Aleppo Codex, I think, represents that in an amazing and beautiful way. And so that's why I would probably encourage people to look into it, to read about it. There are various books about it, but, you know.
Excellent. Okay. This has been absolutely fascinating. I know we could go on, and there's so much more to say, but I think we got an excellent taste of the Aleppo Codex, and urge all our listeners and viewers to explore it more and to check out, of course, Rabbi Becker's books and his ongoing lectures that are online on many different platforms. Rabbi Becker, thank you so much for your time today. It's most appreciated.
Thank you for having me. Kol tov. Bye-bye.